You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And live in Madison, Wisconsin, right at the moment, Tom Hartman here with you. And so pleased to be here with you. A lot in our news today we'll be getting through. It looks like, actually one of the top stories, I think, it turns out the Gulf War Syndrome is actually the result of nerve gas. Question in my mind, and I haven't seen the full report yet, who's nerve gas? But anyhow, we'll get to that. There's odd things going on with Eric Cantor and whatnot. But speaking of odd things going on, this is the epicenter here, Madison, Wisconsin, of odd things going on, at least among Republicans. And Ed Garvey is in the studio with me with the Fighting Bob Fest. He is the editor of FightingBob.com. FightingBobFest.org is the website for information about the event, which is happening tomorrow, all day tomorrow. What is it? 9 in the morning until 5:30 in the afternoon. At the
9 until 5, unless the beer breaks us up earlier. You never know.
Did you say the beer or the bureau?
Beer. The beer. Well, maybe the bureau, too.
Okay. Unless we run out of beer. And he's previously the executive director of the National Football League Players Association, a columnist for Madison's Capital Times, the author of Bidding for Power, senior partner in the law firm Garvey, McNeil & Associates. You got quite a resume. So, and let me just give you a quick summary. Actually, Ed, why don't you do that? What's going on with the Fighting Bob Fest here? Who's going to be here? Who's going to be speaking? What's going to be going on?
Well, this is our 10th Bob Fest, so this is sort of an interesting moment for us, and we decided that the title should be Class Warfare, Fight Back, and so we picked the hero of ours right now, Bernie Sanders, to be the keynote speaker along with Jim Hightower. As you can imagine, Dennis Kucinich and yourself, we're going to have quite a group here. Cornel West will also be here, and Ellen Bravo, Dave Obey, former congressman, Tammy Baldwin, so it's going to be quite an event. We, in the past, have had up to 10,000 people in the audience. We expect the same thing this year.
This is absolutely marvelous, the Fighting Bob Fest. I was asked in a radio interview this morning, is there anything else like this happening around the country? And I speak at the Green Festivals all over the country, and you know they pull 15,000 people, but they're basically, you know, come and see the latest new solar panels kind of things, or you know, here's some great herbal tea, with speakers, and of course there's the national UU Church event is a pretty big deal, but I don't know of anything, but that moves around the country. Is there anything like the Fighting Bob Fest anywhere else in the United States?
I don't think so. And the way it got started, of course, we have to give credit to Jim Hightower, because he originally came up with the idea of having what he called the Rolling Thunder Progressive Chautauquas.
Right.
And we did ours, and we got Paul Simon was our first speaker, and did a terrific job, of course. And the next year we doubled the size of the audience, and then it doubled again, and so on. So I don't think there's anything like it. Tom Harkin has told me that he wants me to come to Iowa and help him set one up there, and Bernie Sanders would like to do one in Vermont. So I think it's a wonderful way to spread the word on a whole variety of issues. I mean, because you come into a community, and you and I could speak and have an impact. When you bring in Bernie and Hightower and Kucinich and so on, it just magnifies the impact that we can have on a community. So we're taking these Bob Fests around the state. We had one in Chippewa Falls this past May. Went over very well. We're going to do one in Milwaukee, do one in Beloit, and do one in Green Bay. You know, our thought is this is one of the biggest or the best organizing tools to try to change the way things are going on in the state of Wisconsin.
For our listeners who are not in Wisconsin and have very little idea what we're talking about, describe what the Fighting Bob Fest is. How does it work? And how, if somebody's living and listening in Los Angeles or in Butte, you know, Montana or something, how might they set up something similar to what's going on here?
Well, I think the main thing that you have to focus on is getting volunteers who are going to do the organizing, make the phone calls, knock on doors, make people get to the central place, have a theme that makes sense to them, that shows that you don't have to be a Republican or a Democrat or a socialist or a Green or whatever in order to participate. We never figure out what anybody's politics are. And then we have, I think, the main ingredient to success is we have fun.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Hightower and I said from the beginning, if you can't have a good time, then don't do it. And I think sometimes the left gets so serious that they almost think it's a failure on your part if you laugh. And what we try to do is enjoy it, have some beer, have some music. Peter Leidy will be singing, all sorts of the Raging Grannies. One of my favorite years is when we had Granny D. Haddock here.
Oh, yeah, she was a friend of mine.
Well, wonderful woman.
Extraordinary woman.
Never forget when she stood up and she said, if you call yourself liberal and you can't do anything about what's going on, then go home.
Right.
We don't need you here. So we want to hold out hope to people in the audience that we can change things. So you bring in people who are certainly to the left, but they are people who can be optimistic about what we can do, whether it's a recall of the governor, a recall of state senators, or electing a progressive to the presidency or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really an effort on our part to give people hope that we can bring about this change. Because sometimes, you know, I think we all have to admit, when you think about climate change and the refusal to recognize what's happening in our society, or the Supreme Court decisions on Citizens United or the Koch brothers' involvement, you can get kind of depressing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to say to people, listen, sorry, but you don't have time to be depressed. You got to get involved and organize and fight back and raise hell.
Yeah, absolutely. And to that point, you said, you know, in order to do something like what you're doing, you've got to find the. Actually, let me shift this question slightly. There are two theories. There's a debate going on nationwide, particularly debate is probably the wrong word. Discussion among progressive groups about why is it that Wisconsin rose up against Scott Walker in ways that Michigan hasn't risen up against Rick Snyder. There were some, you know, demonstrations at the Capitol, but that Florida hasn't risen up against
right.
You know, Rick Scott, that Indiana, Mitch Daniel, you know, on and on, and the list goes. Ohio, Kasich, Maine, even, you know, and I mean, there's a bunch of states where you've got right wing governors who are doing things every bit as bad as what happened here. One theory is that Scott Walker tried to do so much so fast that it just blew people's heads, you know, exploded people's heads, and they went nuts. Another theory is, and the lesson that was learned out of that for conservatives was, you know, make your changes, but make them over the course of a year, not in the first 2 weeks or whatever. Another theory is that what Walker did actually is more egregious. I'm wondering if, you know, a good chunk of the theory should be that the Fighting Bob Fest, that there's a progressive infrastructure here as a result of this party that you have every year.
I think that's right. I mean, that's our perspective anyway, that Fighting Bob Fest sort of prepared us to take on somebody like Walker and absorb some of the blows and to recover quickly and get back on the offensive. I mean, I think there was a moment where the forces of evil, the Koch brothers and Walker and so on, were about to just take over, and we just raised such a ruckus that they had to slow down and come to a halt until we could figure out what was going on, and that became part of the recall efforts. The structure was there. The attitudes were there. We knew each other. There was a friendship that had developed, and people just went at it. I think also the history of Wisconsin. Bob La Follette, Gaylord Nelson. I mean, we've had some wonderful...
You're talking some Republicans.
Well, and we've had some...
Well, as Democrats.
Yeah.
Progressives.
Mostly, that's right.
Yeah. It's, of course, back in the day, I mean, Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican.
That's right. Yeah.
It's important to remember.
Yeah. Well, and the progressives, you know, they joined the Republican Party ultimately. And
that's right.
It was the end of the Progressive Party. But now there's a move, actually, at this Fighting Bob Fest to create another Progressive Party. I don't know whether we'll do it or not, but it's at least out there and people are talking about it.
Well, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. Stick around. I'd like to dig into that if we can. Okay. Ed Garvey is with us. This is it's the Fighting Bob Fest here in Madison, Wisconsin, going on this afternoon. Going on this weekend. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ed Garvey, the guy who is basically coordinating, for lack of a better word, the Fighting Bob Fest with us. We'll be right back with a little more of that. And welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And, I see what's going on. No, I don't. Huh. Welcome back. We are broadcasting from Madison, Wisconsin. We have with us Ed Garvey, who is basically kind of running the Fighting Bob Fest, for lack of a better word.
I'll take all the credit.
Okay.
It's all. I want no one else to stick to it. None of the volunteers, none of our staff.
You mentioned before we went into the break a third party, a progressive party. And Bernie once mentioned on our show, in fact, it ended up going viral, that perhaps President Obama should be primaried. I think he's kind of walked back from that position. But frankly, I don't think there's anybody out there who could or would do it. But the issue of a third party has been a bone in the throat of American democracy since, literally since before the Constitution was ratified. I mean, Madison in Federalist Number 10 goes on at length. Obviously, he had figured out that first past the post, winner take all elections meant that you could basically only have two functioning parties, or you'd end up with the possibility of a minority of people ruling the country. And he didn't have a solution. I mean, it was 1861, I think, when John Stuart Mill came up with proportional representation. And since then, most of the world's democracies have emerged. So how do you do a third party in a way that doesn't end up shooting itself in the foot, or shooting its best allies in the foot, and thus empowering its most virulent opponents?
Well, it's a very tough question. And, you know, we've debated it back and forth. I would guess that if you were to ask people at Fighting Bob Fest, of 10,000 or 8,000, how many ever going to be there? How many of you are members of the Democratic Party? There'd be about 5%, maybe. Republican Party, less.
Right.
So there isn't any.
But that's true right across the board generally, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think it is. And is this an open primary state or a closed primary state?
It's open primary.
Okay, so
Bob LaFollette was the one who created the open primary.
Okay, so there's not a compulsion to be a member of the party here
if you want
to vote in primaries.
In fact, the way LaFollette saw it, the party should be very weak. He hated the idea that the money barons, you know, the robber barons, would go into the room A and select the Republican candidate, and then it'd be room B and select the Democratic candidate, and then let the people decide.
Right.
But he said if you have an open primary where people nominate the candidates, all will go well. Well, the problem is Bob LaFollette didn't realize about 30-second spots and how much money the Koch brothers could put in to win the primary.
Well, neither did the founders. And
right. Nobody ever thought of it.
Yeah. But there's also, you know, open primaries also leave you open for mischief. I grew up in Michigan, and I was in Michigan, I think it was the election of 68, when the Republican Party openly said Republicans should cross over in the primary, in the Democratic primary, and vote for George Wallace just to embarrass the Democrats.
Sure.
And Michigan was the only state that sent George Wallace as the presidential nominee. But there's a lot of closed primary states in the country. Here's where I was going with this. There is a third party arguably out there right now. It's called a Tea Party. And they have infiltrated and taken over the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't we be using that as a model?
Well, perhaps. I mean, and I think that's why people have said to me as they prepare for this Bob Fest, we want to at least get into the discussion. Do we want to have a Tea Party like on the left? Or what do we want to do here? Do you want to have a party that nominates candidates, or just a party that defines issues? I mean, it seems to me that one of the things we have to avoid is using all our energy to create a third party rather than to reverse the Supreme Court decisions on Citizens United. I mean, we've got to amend our Constitution, but I think we also have to be ready for what the alternatives might be. But I'm thoroughly undecided when it comes to a third party. I mean, I think there's something to be said for it, but it takes tremendous energy and some finances to make it work, and I'm not sure we've got that kind of support.
Yeah, and that's the thing that the Koch brothers were able to do, and Dick Armey. I mean, Dick Armey's worth millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. The Koch brothers, billions.
Right.
In creating the infrastructure for the Tea Party, hiring people don't realize, and people in the Tea Party, I find it amazing. You know, conservatives, Republicans, they come on my show and they'll go, "Oh, this is totally grassroots." Well, then who paid for the big, major Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles, and New York City PR firms that charge millions of dollars to do, that got those Tea Party events in the news?
Right.
And,
and almost to make your point, when you think about the effort we put in for one thing called Fighting Bob Fest, I mean, we've a tremendous year-round effort to make sure we get good people, get the speakers we need to draw the crowds and so on. If you look at this on a national level of having a political movement,
right,
it is pretty scary in terms of how much time and effort you would have to go into it. And we don't have that kind of money.
And money is the,
it's just the money.
It seems that money is
there.
The main thing. And increasingly in America, it's money rules.
Right.
And the I think the big challenge of our time, the big challenge of democracy, the big challenge of America right now is how do we get to a point where the people rule instead of money rules, because we're right back where Bob La Follette was,
right.
You know, we're right back where the Robert
Burns. We're back. I mean, it's unbelievable. So, you know, we ask for, we fight for public financing of elections, and then the Supreme Court says, oops, you can't do that.
Right. They just knocked down
people.
Right. They knocked down Arizona's.
And everybody knows that it's nonsense to think of a corporation as a person, but
right.
You have Mitt Romney and the Supreme Court saying, oh, you know, they are. So I don't know. It'll be an interesting discussion at VobFest. My suspicion is that there will be much more emphasis on how we define the issues and a willingness to say to the Democrats, if you are not going to take positions that we feel are important and helpful to the vast majority of the people, we're just not going to support you.
Right.
I mean, people say, well, you can't do that because the alternative to Obama is very bad. We say, well, you know, that's true, but we've been saying that for years, and I think maybe it's time to say we're going to take some steps in that direction.
Yeah, I would be gung-ho in favor of it if the long-term plan was to infiltrate the Democratic Party, take it over from within, and use that as the infrastructure to do it. And I think that a large part of that is already there with the Progressive Caucus that Bernie Sanders helped start. It's just a matter of herding the cats. Ed Garvey, thanks for being with us, Ed.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for coming to VobFest.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with some of the news of the day and your thoughts here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
Thank God it's...
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and in Madison, Wisconsin, and TGIF. That's right, indeed. Oh, man, what an amazing week it has been. There is a leaked document. This is pretty amazing. This is quite amazing. This is the result of Senator Bernie Sanders letting out confidential data about oil speculation to a number of media outlets. I mean, he just laid this out, including the Wall Street Journal. Ordinarily, I'm looking at this over at the Center for American Progress's Think Progress site. Lee Fong is on this story. This is incredible. Who did the oil? Remember when the price of oil went to $4 a gallon in 2008? Who is responsible for that? It had nothing to do with supply and demand. We were told that story, but no, it had nothing to do with supply and demand. It turns out who held the total long positions, who held the total short positions. In other words, who was churning the price of oil. Now, you would expect long and short positions, you know, betting on the price of oil should be things like oil companies and airlines, oil companies and railroads, oil companies and gas refining companies, you know, people who use oil. Actually, the lead, Vital SA, I'm not sure who that is. SA would be not an American company. So that's conceivably, they held 412,000 long positions. But the company that held the largest number of long positions, 415,907, and 419,000 short positions, in other words, betting on oil both ways, which drives the price up, Goldman Sachs. Yeah, they use a lot of oil over there at Goldman Sachs. The number two company that was doing this was Morgan Stanley Group. Seriously, Morgan Stanley. The number, I'm not making this up. I mean, this is just incredible. The number three company that was doing this, just to recap, let me just reboot this and recap this. The document, Senator Sanders released the documents. We're broadcasting live today from Madison, Wisconsin, by the way, for Fighting BobFest tomorrow. It's going to be a huge event. Greg Palast is going to be here. Senator Sanders, Tammy Baldwin, Cornell West, Jim Hightower, Dave Obey, Greg Palast. I think I mentioned John Nichols, me. And And Senator Bernie Sanders, who's on his way, he's on a plane right here, right now, on his way here, which is why he's not doing our show live this moment, why he did it yesterday, released this information. Who were the speculators behind the oil bubble of 2008 when the price of oil went up and then it crashed again? Matt Taibbi has written in the Rolling Stone about, you know, the people behind, that Goldman Sachs was principally the company behind the food price bubble in 2008 that led to starvation around the world, riots, people dying, and made a pile of money for speculators. And now Bernie has released this information. You can read this. Leaked documents reveal major speculators behind 2008 oil price shock. Hedge funds, Coke, big banks, oil companies. Who were the people who were speculating? The lead speculators from the top down. Vitol S.A., 428,000 short positions, 412,000 long positions. Goldman Sachs, 451,000. I'll just give you the short position. 419,000 bets against oil. Morgan Stanley Group, 320,000 bets. Barclays Bank, 278,000. J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, 246,000. Deutsche Bank, 232,000. Credit Suisse Group, 191,000. Do you hear anybody? Do you hear any airlines in here? You know, the major consumers of oil who should be betting in the oil market, I mean, actually should be betting in the oil market, I'm not hearing that. I mean, this is really quite remarkable. Oh, and just to finish the list here, Credit Suisse, 191,000 short positions. Societe Generale, the French bank, 156,000. Lehman Brothers, 145,000 long positions. There's BNP Paribas S.A. Again, this might be an actual oil company or it might be a bank. I don't know. Merrill Lynch, 122,000. And then finally we get down to the oil companies. BP had 100,000 positions. Hess Corporation had 90,000. Coke Supply and Trading, 76,000. You could argue that at least the Koch brothers, they got an oil company. Bank of America, 64,000. So who is speculating in oil? Well, it turns out it wasn't the oil companies. It was the banksters. Pretty amazing stuff. I mean, genuinely astounding, amazing stuff. By the way, in a speech yesterday, John Boehner, you know, Mr. Hell No, You Can't, said that the American Jobs Act, President Obama's job creation legislation, is a poor substitute for actual job creation policies. What are their absolute job creation policies over the Republican Party? Tax cuts for billionaires. Surprise, surprise, tax breaks for billionaires. What else? What else would it be? 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Jim in Southfield, Michigan. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I've been a Democratic activist for years. I'm an elected official. I agree that we need to get people.
Jim, you just vanished. You still there? No, Jim. You'll have to call back. Your cell phone just croaked. I think what Jim was talking about was in the first half hour of the program, we had Ed Garvey on, who's the organizer of the local Bob Fest. This event that I'm speaking at. There's going to be like 10,000 people, or at least there were last year. I'm guessing there'll be probably even more this year. And it's going to be Saturday here in Madison, Wisconsin, at the Alliant Energy Center Coliseum. And what Ed said was that there is a serious conversation going on among serious progressives here in the state of Wisconsin about creating a third party. And my question to Ed was, how do you do that without empowering the Republican Party? Because that's basically been the history of third parties. How do you do that? It seems to me that there is actually a model for doing that, and that model is the Tea Party. So you create a third party, and then you embed it inside one of the two larger established parties and basically take it over. And I think that that has happened at various times in our past. The anti-war movement, it basically embedded itself into the Democratic Party during the Nixon presidency in a big way. mean, there were candidates who were elected to office nationwide just because they were anti-war, anti-Vietnam War candidates. And then the Tea Party came along and embedded itself inside the Republican Party. But I don't know another way to do that. Cordell in L.A. Hey, Cordell, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the, I guess it's not too recent, but the way that we have a lot more participation from, you know, churches and pastors and so on that are actually promoting candidates and causes within the church in the United States. Now, I know that people have spoken about challenging their tax-exempt status and things like that, but mm-hmm. I read an article, it was on the front page of the LA Times last Sunday, and the article cited, I believe, that one of the near-term goals of the some of the folks in the Tea Party and on the right is to create legislation that will make it so that you can't challenge a church on their tax-exempt status because they are promoting a political agenda in their church. Now, I see this as being a tremendous challenge to a progressive, any kind of a progressive effort due to the funding of, you know, big money interests. So I just was wondering what your thoughts on that, if you could elaborate a little bit.
The deal that Lyndon Johnson made with the churches in 64, I think it was, that they could have tax-exempt status for pretty much everything that they were doing rather than a very limited and local tax-exempt status. They could have a federal tax-exempt status if they did not participate in political action, has broken down badly. I mean, you know, Jerry Falwell broke that thing down. It started breaking down in the 80s badly and is now badly wounded. Although there were a couple of progressive churches, you'll recall, during the, I think it was the 2004 Bush campaign, that the Republicans went after because somebody from the pulpit dared to speak well of John Kerry. And so there were these challenges. Yeah, it's a tough one. It's like, you know, what are we going to do about this? How do we deal with this? I don't have an answer. I can give you the glib answer. The glib answer is I don't think the churches should be tax exempt, period.
I don't
except
think
for
so
monasteries.
Either.
No, I'm serious about monasteries because they don't have any way of making enough money to pay their property taxes.
Fair enough there. And just to be clear, you know, I don't have any problem with religious freedom. I think that's a great thing, and I think people, you know, that's a freedom that anybody who lives in America or comes to America should be able to enjoy. But it seems to me that there is an unspoken effort to make America become a Christian-only nation, and I think that's a super slippery slope, and we are headed in that direction.
There has been an effort like that underway in this country since the founding of this country, and we've always pushed back and said, no, you know, government should be secular. Cordell, it is going to be a challenge. You're absolutely right. You've identified one.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls and thoughts here on Anything Goes Friday, live from Madison, Wisconsin today. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you from Madison, Wisconsin. Always helps to turn the microphone on, doesn't it? Anything Goes Friday. Let's just pick up your calls here. Some of the things in the news, we figured out about the banksters. Enough said. Let's get to your calls. Jim in Canton, Ohio. Hey, Jim, what's up?
How you doing, man? I love your show.
Thanks.
A lot of interesting things on it, and I enjoy watching Bernie, too. It was an interesting fact you brought about these banksters and their hedge bets this morning.
Mm-hmm. And that's information Bernie brought us. You know, I mean, yeah, he brought the country, you know.
And it just is amazing. You know, maybe Elizabeth Warren should have been, and that's why they weasel her out of there, huh? The politics of the government, you know. She wasn't part of that commission.
She is going to be up against, I mean, she's up against Scott Brown, who's already taken millions from the banksters and given the banksters billions with a B. You know, Scott Brown has had legislation passed that gives the banksters billions of dollars.
Yeah,
so
but see,
it's going to be a tough one for her.
Yeah, but see, the money rules the world. You know, he who has the most gold wins. And we have a three-party system. Everyone says three-party system, and it's really the Democrats, Republicans, and the Jews. And that's where we're fighting that money, you know, the money thing. Who has the most
give
gold?
Give me a break. Jim in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Okay, I'm back again. the thing is, I totally agree that people should join the Democratic parties, Democratic clubs, go to the meetings. But when you do, you'll discover that between the Greens and the Democrats, there's no light. The thing is, there's a light between the activists and the elected officials. If you want to change it, you got to join the parties and then run for office.
Right.
Because if you run for office, that's where you make the changes. And we got to make sure we do that. I mean, that's what I did. I'm in office now, and I'm making changes. So
that's great.
That's how you got to do it. It's not enough to join the parties. You got to take them over by running for office.
What's the office you're running? You're in.
I'm a county commissioner.
That is spectacular, and that's the point: is that we need to build an infrastructure from the ground up, from precinct
right.
committee people to county commissioners to state representatives. And the Republicans have been doing this very carefully, very methodically, very thoughtfully, very thoroughly for 30 years now longer.
You run for office, you go door to door. If you go door to door, you can overcome the money, and because people want to hear our message, they want to hear the progressive message. We're a progressive country. And if you go out and you meet people, that's how you get elected.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Thanks for what you're doing and keep it up.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jim. Good hearing from you. Kenny in Macon, Georgia. Hey, Kenny, what's up?
Oh, hey, Tom. I love your show. I'm a big fan of yours.
Thank you. No need to do all the obligatory hellos and stuff.
No.
I'm
like a big fan of yours.
Okay.
Like
Thank
a huge
you.
Fan.
So, your question.
Oh, yes. Precinct committee, man. When you started talking about it, I wondered about it and wanted to try to find out, you know, how I can be part of it. Mm-hmm. But apparently here, nobody knows what it is. Even when I went to the posters, they didn't know what it is. They were like, well, it's a precinct committee, man. I went to City Hall. They didn't know. I went to the DNC. They didn't know. It didn't seem to exist around here. Do you know what I should do?
Well, there may be a different name for it in Georgia, but I would suggest that you contact your local Democratic Party.
Oh, I tried. A friend of mine's parents actually worked there, work at the DNC,
right.
And the offices were closed.
Well, you're talking about the Democratic National Committee. I'm talking about the Macon, Georgia Democratic Party. And
I asked about that in City Hall, directing me right to the same place. There didn't seem to be one. I mean, I don't know if like you said, it could have been under a different name or something.
Yeah, there has to be a Democratic Party in Macon. If there's not, then,
there is a Democratic Party. They're real big here. It's just
right.
I can't find the precinct committee man or whatever they're called.
Right. Well, that's the point. Maybe a different name. I would show up at one of the meetings. I mean, just show, you know, find out when they're having their meetings and show up at the meetings and introduce yourself to a few people and start asking the questions and say, you know, that you have an interest in participating. And, you'll find your way through it. It's it may be a different, like I said, might be a different name. It may be, I frankly don't know the rules of how the Democratic Party works in Georgia, but I lived there for a long time, but mostly I just voted at that time and I was running a business, but that's where I'd start, Kenny. I would begin there. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Mark in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Yeah, Tom. I want to make sure that people are aware of something about what's going on in Pennsylvania. Seemingly, the Republicans are gerrymandering the congressional districts so that they're more Republican-friendly. And then they're trying to establish in the presidential election that one electoral vote will go per congressional district.
Right.
So therefore, if Obama were to win the state, the popular vote, he could still lose the electoral count.
That's right.
And I think this is very, very dangerous because, it seems to be an idea that's spreading. And I want to ask you what we as citizens can do to try and counteract this.
Well, this is a problem because the Republicans are pushing this thing, and they're pushing it in states. They're not pushing it in the states where it would work to their disadvantage, but in the states where it would work to their advantage, they're pushing it really hard. And what you're talking about is that the way that 49 states do it right now, and I'm not sure how the 50th handles it, but the way that 49 states handle it right now is whoever gets the most electoral votes in the state gets all the electoral votes in the state. And the electoral votes that a state offers is the two senators and all the members of the House of Representatives. And so, you know, whatever that may be. So Vermont has one member of Congress and two members of the Senate, so they have three electoral votes. If you were, so it's not so much a factor for the smaller states, but a larger state, I mean, Pennsylvania, I think, has almost 20, you know, members of Congress. And so they've got, you know, and two senators. And so,
yes, and 18 districts and the two senators. So
18 and the two, election. Yeah, okay, so there you go. And so, you know, the last, I think, four or six, maybe even eight elections, the Democrats have carried Pennsylvania at the presidential level, even though there are Republicans who are winning elections in Pennsylvania, and this is their way of getting. Let me pick that up when we come back from the at the beginning of the next hour. Let me pick that topic up again. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman
on the news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the state. It's a little hot, isn't it? In the state of Texas, if you are in the bottom 20% economically, you pay four times as much tax. Here, let me read this straight out. According to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, someone in the poorest 20% of Texans can expect to face a tax rate four times as high as Texans in the richest 1%. But you say, but the poorest 20% are so poor they're not even paying federal income taxes. No, but the state has figured out a whole lot of ways to tax you. And Rick Perry is running on that. The poorest 20% pays a tax rate four times as high as the richest 1% in the state of Texas. Go figure. John Lewis and 50 other congressmen have signed on to this request that the Georgia Parole Board grant Troy Davis clemency. This is growing. This is going. I yesterday when I think it was when I was going through the airport, maybe a little earlier anyhow, I saw Anderson Cooper was doing the story on CNN, and I thought, aha, bingo, this thing is migrating. So we'll see what happens. Gutsy, that's how the Reverend Jerry Falwell Jr., yes, there is a Reverend Jerry Falwell Jr., described Governor Rick Perry's suggestion that Texas may secede from the Union. Perry spoke earlier at Liberty University, Falwell's university. And you add this stuff up and it just gets amazing. But anyhow, let's it's Anything Goes Friday, so we'll pick up your calls here. Bill in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
I wanted to just comment on the list that Bernie Sanders just released. And just for the sake, I used to work in the oil business, but I left them. I'm now retired. And knowing a little bit about it, I decided to do a little bit of speculation. I'm a small investor, and I went through my broker, Morgan Stanley. And when you see those positions, it doesn't mean necessarily that Morgan Stanley or Citibank or any or Goldman Sachs is actually speculating. It could be a lot of little people like myself. So you've got to be a little careful about painting them with that kind of a brush. And the other thing is, this is kind of what they do. If you ask for a list of who had long positions in coffee beans, for example, I'd be surprised if you saw Starbucks at the top of the list. These companies speculate. They're a vehicle for speculation. And it's you really have to be careful not to paint them with too broad a brush.
Bill, I appreciate your stirring defense of the banks, but I can tell you, go back and read Matt Taibbi's research on food speculation, for example, on these things. These banks are speculating. They are holding these positions. And your position may be in your name, or it may be in your bank's name or your investment bank's name, but they are doing this. And they are doing it in a concerted fashion. They're doing it in ways that drive prices nuts in commodities. And frankly, it should be either taxed so that it's not profitable to churn commodities, as we used to do with the security transaction excise tax, STET tax, or it should be simply banned, as it was before the Enron loophole was passed back in 2000. You know, Phil Graham, the famous, his wife Wendy was on the board of Enron, and they got the Enron loophole passed. But before that, there were a lot of things that, you know, if you were not an actual player in the commodities market, you couldn't speculate in the commodities market. If you weren't a producer or a user, there was no place for you there. And that seems to me like actually a good thing, that, you know, how it should be. So anyhow, Margie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hey, Margie.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to discuss these people that want to end minimum wage requirements, and I'm assuming they also want to end fair labor laws.
Mm-hmm.
I work in an industry that is not covered by minimum wage or fair wage laws.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what we do for no pay whatsoever. I'm a truck driver, and if our wheels are not moving forward, we're not being paid. So all of the things that we do, such as fueling our trucks, inspecting our trucks, load securement, all of that type of stuff, we don't get any pay for.
Right.
If these laws are turned back, that's what everybody's going to be doing.
Margie, are
it's
you...
not just Lord... Go ahead.
I'm wondering if you're old enough to remember what the trucking industry was like before Jimmy Carter deregulated or started the deregulation process. Reagan really finished it, but it happened mostly in 79, 80, and 81.
No, I'm not that old.
Okay. I am. and I've never been a trucker, but one of my friends is, and a kid I grew up in high school with. And before the deregulation of the trucking industry, trucking basically was a unionized industry. It was a good job. It was a career. There was a fair number of independent truckers out there, but they could make a good living because they were competing against companies that were unionized and that were regulated, and the playing field was relatively level. And with deregulation came basically cutthroat competition, and big companies basically came in and wiped out a lot of the independents, and the few independents that are left are hanging on by their teeth or working their butts off in ways that are just, you know, beyond the pale. And you're right. If this, you know, from industry to industry, when the Republicans say get rid of the regulations, what they're really saying is get rid of the regulations that protect workers, get rid of the regulations that protect children, get rid of the regulations that protect the environment, get rid of the regulations and it's not even that most of these regulations diminish profits, because, you know, if you regulate, an industry and say, okay, you can't throw toxic benzene into the air, then they've got to come up with a way to continue doing what they're doing, making plastic or whatever, without throwing toxic benzene in the air. They have to innovate. They have to develop something new. It creates new jobs. But to the point, the specific point that you were making, back to that.
Well, I mean, like I said, when you were talking last week of, you know, that we can work, you know, that people will be stuck working for low wages.
Yeah.
If these go through, people will be stuck working for no wages.
Yeah.
The other thing is, specifically with the trucking industry, and this is going to start with other industries too, is they're actually bringing, within the next month, Mexican truck drivers are going to be allowed to drive in the U.S. We're going to be competing against Mexican trucks that they pay their wages are nothing.
Right.
The trucks don't need to make the standards that the U.S. trucks, their EPA standards are different.
Yep.
Americans can't even go into Mexico with their trucks because we can't fuel. This is supposed to be reciprocity under NAFTA. We can't even get fuel for our trucks in Mexico because they do not have ultra-low sulfur diesel. How is this supposed to be reciprocity when they can come here and we can't go there?
Yeah.
And the newest one is FMCSA
isn't going down there to do the on-site inspections because they're afraid for their safety. How many truckers do you think from America want to go into a drug war zone to deliver high-value loads?
Right. And this is why we should have national boundaries and borders and trade policies that put the nation first, like pretty much every other nation on earth does. And yes, I know that there's a whole bunch of countries that have joined the World Trade Organization and you know, NAFTA is us, Mexico and Canada. There's CAFTA, there's all these SHAFTA, there's all these other agreements. But what all these other companies or countries do is they figured out ways to continue to protect their manufacturing industry. And we haven't. In fact, we have been stripping our manufacturing industry of protections. And it's nuts. It's absolutely insane. It is destroying this country. It is, however, making very, very profitable big transnational corporations and their CEOs.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday. Back with your calls in just a few minutes. Welcome back. I had left one topic hanging, and that was the whole Pennsylvania thing. I think it was at the top of the last hour. And just very quickly to wrap that up, what the Republicans are trying to do is they're trying to say that state you can't have winner-take-all elections for the presidency, the Electoral College, in those states where it would benefit Republicans not to have them. Now, some Republicans are starting to get nervous about this because it might benefit Democrats at some point in the future as well. I think, frankly, we need to go to a one-man, one vote for the entire nation, get rid of the Electoral College altogether, or keep the system as it is. But, you know, but I could be wrong, too, because the reason why the Republicans are concerned is that right now, most of the campaigning that goes on is only in the big cities in Pennsylvania, which tend to go Democratic, and so the campaigns get fought there. And they then quietly hang on to the Republican rural areas. But if those areas were in play, then suddenly the Democrats would start campaigning in those areas, and Republicans might start losing in those areas. So there's like layers within layers to all this. I just find the whole thing fascinating. But anyway, Sharon in Belleville, Michigan. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I have a question about the Wall Street speculation with that report from Matt Taibbi and Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. I know the CFTC was being held up not passing the new speculation regulations, I guess the Frank Dodd bill, mm-hmm. from the one member on there, the Blue Dog Democrat, I think he was, Mike Dodd. And he was supposed to be replaced in June. And I haven't heard a word on anybody's show, yours, Maddow's, or anywhere, if he was replaced and what's holding him up now was stopping or getting the speculation under control. And,
The Consumer Finance Protection Board you're talking about?
No, the Commodities Futures Trading.
Oh, the Commodity Futures Trading. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, my recollection is that that's if that requires Senate confirmation, that would be one of the things that the Republicans have been blocking in the Senate. But
no, they're all there. It's just that the one guy, the one Democrat was
right.
Voting with the Republican side, saying, "Well, we don't know if speculation is actually driving up the cost of gas
right.
and food," and you know, he was blocking all the new regulations going to be put in place for the speculation, but his term was up in June, and Obama was supposed to either replace him or
I honestly don't know, Sharon. It's something that I'm sure Jacob is making a note. We will track that down and report back to you. Okay.
And one more thing, I
yes.
just found out earlier this week. I'm from Michigan, and of course we've been sending around these recall petitions for Snyder and our Tea Party people, Pat
yeah.
Somerville and Kolbeck, and the EFM law. And I just learned that the Michigan Democratic Party isn't helping anybody in this state with those recalls. You know, it's just all grassroots people. But I just don't have a clue. But now they've kicked up there. They're going to start helping the people in Wisconsin, but they're not helping the Democrats here in this state. And I just wondered why, if you knew anything.
You're talking about
that.
The National Democratic Party.
No, Michigan Democratic.
Okay, why would the Michigan Democratic Party be helping people in Wisconsin?
I don't know, but they just started doing that. They decided to help them.
Yeah.
But they said that they've been, and this is from blogging from Michigan.com and Eglecta blog.
Right.
It's to, they're saying the MDP has not helped any of us in here. To
Sharon, I'm batting 0-2 here.
Okay.
I don't know the intricacies of the politics of the inside of the Michigan Democratic Party at all, and certainly not well enough to answer the question about why. But you've put it out there in front of 3 million people, and hopefully somebody will have the answer and will share it with us, and we'll find out.
Have a Michiganders call MDP and ask them why the heck they're not helping us. Because I've sent around a few petitions and got a few signatures.
Yeah.
But, yeah, let everybody call.
Well, it could be, you know, it could be, and this would be a good question for Ed Garvey or for Tim Carpenter, who's going to be on at the top of the next hour. Is, you know, there are, like, you know, in Ohio, in Wisconsin, well, in Wisconsin, I guess, is probably the most famous one to recall Scott Walker. At the end of the year, the beginning of the year, whenever it is that he's eligible to be recalled. And, you know, whether the party is going to try and stay out of that to make it, you know, look like it is genuinely, and actually be genuinely grassroots, or if the party's staying, or if the party's jumping in Wisconsin. I don't know, you know, the Wisconsin Democratic Party. But we'll find out. Thank you for the call, Sharon. Tough questions. Tough questions. Mark in Patterson, Mississippi. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, I called on 9/11, and I was the one that said that no one, you know, chooses how they come into the world, what color, what race, gay or straight or whatever.
I remember your call.
Right. And so I want to talk about the common denominator, which is race. And I just lost my train of thought, but if the Tea Party is mostly white, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I heard you talking about trying to have it like a Democratic, you know, Tea Party, like a Tea Party, you know, something like a
right.
Tea Party within a Democratic.
A progressive movement that would
right.
that would insert itself into the Democratic Party the way the Tea Party has inserted itself into the Republican Party.
Right. And since most of the Tea Party, would you agree, is white, then most of this party would have to be African-American or people of color, you know, Mexicans and what have you in America.
Well, to a large extent, and this is something the Republicans love to point out. In fact, the racism implicit in many of the attacks on Obama, for example. To a large extent, the Black Caucus in Congress, for example, is Democratic. I think they may have had one Republican member, and Alan West, and I think he pulled out. And so, yeah, there is a certain racial divide there. Probably more for economic than for racial reasons. Because, you know, whites tend to be more wealthy than blacks. But it's an interesting point that you make, Mark. Thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with more of your calls after this. Goes Friday. Tom Hartman here with you. Tom in Waterloo, Iowa. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I got a quick comment for you on the notorious Ron Paul answer on health care.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that his son had basically made my point in a sense that the Republicans failed to establish exactly what they would consider to be well-to-do. I mean, the fact of the matter is that a person working a 50-hour work week and making approximately $30,000 a year is not going to be able to buy much of a health care policy. And if you do, you're going to be coughing up well over a quarter of your weekly wage.
Right.
Now, you could go with the standard program and be uninsured, or like some of us working poor have to do, you know, you might have to bite the bullet and try to live without health insurance in order to cover your other living expenses, which, as you know, probably plays a huge role in poverty in America.
Half of all bankruptcies in the United States are caused by medical people having medical disasters. Half of all bankruptcies.
Yes, good point. And that hence the need for single-payer health care.
Yeah, I mean, the damage... Yeah, set aside the fact that the CEOs of these giant for-profit health companies live in 10, 20, 30 bedroom mansions with staffs and butlers who wake them up in the morning and maids that bring their clothes or their food rather and kitchen staff and fly around in private jets and have become part of the ruling elite of America. I mean, just set that aside for a moment. Set aside for a moment the fact that people who invest in these companies can literally, on the dividend checks that they get, make their living sitting on their butt around the pool, just waiting for the dividend checks to come in and not pay any Social Security tax on it and pay, a maximum 15% income tax. Forget all that. Even setting all that aside, the fact that half of all bankruptcies in the United States are the result of medical crises that people have, and many of those people have insurance. About half of them, about a quarter of those people who went bankrupt, had insurance when they had. And that's how bad it is in this country, and that's how badly in need of fixing it is. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Yeah, I lived the trucking deregulation. I was driving at the time. I seen what happened.
Okay, give us a quick snapshot, because I only saw it through watching the life of a friend of mine, and we had this woman call in earlier, who was a trucker who was not old enough to remember what it was like back in the day when trucking was a profession where you could make a decent living and actually have a retirement when you're done.
Well, that's because everything became a backhaul. A backhaul is something you take for cheap to get home.
Right.
Or get back to your base.
Right.
Prior to that, you had to have rights. In other words, they sectioned the country off, the Northeast, the Midwest, Central America, and you had to have rights to go in there and pick that freight up. Now, you had two types of freight. You had a truckload. And then you had LTL, less than a truckload. Now, they knew how much freight was coming out of that particular area, the Northeast. Mm. So they would issue rights for so many trucks to go in there and pick that freight up and deliver freight in there. So what you would do is take the freight in, deliver it, then pick the freight coming out, and you had to have rights for that.
Right.
Now, with deregulation, the people made money. Because they had to pay a certain rate on that freight. Mm-hmm. They couldn't pay less. So the truck drivers and the companies had enough money to maintain their equipment, pay their drivers well, and the benefits. Now, after deregulation, anybody who had two nickels to rub together could go buy a truck.
Right.
Now, they were running trucks 500 and 700 miles to go to the Northeast to pick up a load going to California. Now, that is wasting fuel. You got an empty truck running 700 miles. You never had that during regulation.
Right. So the point of regulation was to make sure that the trucking industry was actually more efficient.
Right.
Oddly
efficient,
enough.
Profitable, so they could maintain their equipment and the people were paid well. So
right.
Now everything became a backhaul.
Mm-hmm.
You had a guy in New England who wanted to get back to Chicago.
Right.
So he would bid on the load. I seen him up on the board. They posted him on the board.
Yeah.
And they say, okay, it pays $1,200 to go to Chicago.
I think, Corky, we're starting to get into a level of detail here that's going to make people who are not truckers' eyes glaze over. But the bottom line is that before deregulation, when trucking was a regulated industry, it was working well. Things were delivered. The costs did not radically go down as a result of deregulation of transporting material. In fact, you could argue that many of the costs have actually gone up. And truckers could make a decent living.
Right. And the most important thing there is you weren't wasting fuel.
Right. Yeah.
Because you weren't burning empty miles.
I got it. Corky, thank you very much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Thanks for those insights. Caleb in Portland. Hey, Caleb, what's up?
Well, besides the fact we're missing you here in Portland, you know, Tom, you focus on a lot of things that no one else does. And one of your things that you focus on, I think, is just terrific, is if we're all efficient to the max, we don't provide jobs for people. I don't know if you saw the McClatchy research about 2 weeks ago, and they asked business owners, do you want to increase regulation or is that a problem? Most of them said no, but the last woman they interviewed said, you know, we're losing jobs because of the internet. People don't come to my shop anymore. Mm-hmm. One of his books is bankrupt because of the internet. What are your thoughts about that, and what's going to happen in the future?
Well, the thing is that in order to kickstart the internet business, this decision was made not to charge sales tax, to make it illegal to charge sales tax on internet-based purchases. And yeah. That, you know, grew Amazon and others like crazy. And now the individual states are starting to come in and say, hey, wait a minute, this is driving our local businesses out of business. And the internet is mature. It's a mature industry now. Now it's time to start charging sales tax. And after all, they're using computers. It's not like they can't easily figure out which state it's being shipped to and automatically calculate the sales tax and, you know, set it aside and ship it off to this, you know, once a year, send a check to the state or once a month or however often. So, you know, I think that that's a big piece of it. I think also the fact that it's kind of a perfect storm, Caleb. The other part of it is that in the 1980s, in the early 80s, when Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act,
the
local small businesses that would be competitive with the internet, that, you know, were they still out there today? Because they're local small businesses, people know them, they want to patronize them, they have a sense of community around them, they're participating in the, you know, their store is right next door, right down. They're gone. They've been put out of business by the big chains. And so basically your choice is you can go online and occasionally find small businesses, but more often than not, people are going to the big chains online, whether it's, you know, Macy's.com or whether it's Amazon.com, or they're going to the big chains locally. And so it's just the retail landscape in this country has changed dramatically. And I am a fan of inefficiency in many regards. Yeah. I think that we need a certain level of inefficiency. And this is, you know, the whole argument that Reagan made for not enforcing the Sherman Act anymore was that as companies got bigger, they got more efficient, which is true. What was sacrificed was jobs. You know, two banks merge, as is just about to happen again. Two banks merge. What do? They fire. You know, now they've got two back offices. They only need one payroll department. They don't need two. So they fire half of the combined staff, and so. Number one, we lost a lot of jobs as the result of these megalopolies. But secondly, we lost competition. You know, small companies preventing large companies from being so predatory, from reaching what I call the cancer stage of capitalism, preventing that from emerging led us into where we are in this cancer stage of capitalism. So, Caleb, that's my, you know, my take on the answer to your question. You know, for what it's worth. Thanks a lot for the call. Peter in Rochester, New York. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was wondering what you thought of an idea I had, and that is to have the Congressional Progressive Caucus have a professionally produced description of the people's budget, using the members to make the presentation, coordinating their 5-minute speech time in blocks to present it on C-SPAN. This way they're able to get the description out there and it would be available for mass, distribution. Building a movement behind the better plan and challenging the two established parties, the two established positions to do more.
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. The whole idea of a you're talking about a third party here, basically.
Well, instead of trying to find a candidate to run with the message, let's get the message out. The people's budget is out there. It is probably the most logical, reasonable thing to do. It has the backing of The Economist magazine and a couple of other recognized individual economists. Mm-hmm. But the problem is the message hasn't been out there. Nobody's covering it. This way, if you have a professionally done presentation utilizing the individual members advocating those positions, not only are they getting it out there initially, it's also able to be put out there by others who find it interesting and can, again, you know, they can go to the website, either C-SPAN or eventually on hopefully maybe YouTube or something else.
I think even more important is to get more and more progressives elected. I think everything else organically comes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And that means we all show up. We're going to take a break here. I got to reboot my Skype. We'll be right back. There you go. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on Anything Goes Friday. And let's see here. Everett in Kenmore, Washington. Hey, Everett, what's up?
Tom Hartman, hi. I try to watch your show each day that it's on. This is my first time to get through. Unfortunately, your end of the line is kind of breaking up, so I'll just ask a couple quick questions, unrelated yet very important. The first, I have this growing suspicion that that the Republicans around the country aren't really winning some of these elections, that there might be some election fraud.
You want to check into that. Google redshift, that phrase, redshift. And what it is that for 100 years in the United States, we were able to predict the outcome of an election back when my mom was an election worker in the 1950s and 60s. And she'd sit at the local school and you know, sign people in and things like that. I mean, people voted on paper, and they didn't really actually have the count until the next day. So how did they know who won? They did it through exit polls. And the exit polls were always within a tenth or a two-tenths of a percent of being accurate, as they are. This is how the European countries do it. It's how Canada does it. And, in fact, it's how the United Nations determines whether an election is actually being conducted fairly in other countries. Starting in 1996 or 98, you'd have to go back and look, there started this weird phenomenon started to occur, and it seemed to coincide with the appearance of electronic voting machines, and that was called redshift, and that was that the polls, the exit polls, would indicate that there was a certain percentage of the vote, say, you know, 51% of the vote went for the Republican, but the voting machines were saying, no, it was 55%. And what you found was that the redshift was occurring, as I said, in those states where those kinds of things could happen, and it was measurable to the point where in the 2000 election, the exit polls clearly showed that Al Gore won, which ultimately we know he did, but I mean, even in Florida. And in the 2004 election, the exit polls clearly showed that John Kerry won. And by that point in 2004, because there was such a difference between the exit polls and what the reported vote was by the electronic machines, the networks who were funding these exit polls and had been for decades would, at the end of the evening, readjust their exit poll results to reflect what the machines said. It was called recalibrating or readjusting. You know, all of this information, none of this is a secret, and it's not weird conspiracy theory stuff. The conspiracy theory stuff comes into trying to answer the question why. Why is it that in the last 15 years, exit polls have become unreliable in the United States, whereas they are still reliable in every other country in the world and are still the standard that the United States uses? When we declared that the election in the Ukraine, for example, was illegitimate, we declared that based on exit polls. Why is it that exit polls are still the gold standard around the world, but we no longer even do them in the United States because they've become so unreliable? Anyway, back to you.
So do you think that there's possibly electronic voting fraud with the
voting machine? I don't think it's possible. I think it's probable.
Okay. And my other question, this is about Troy Davis. I called the governor of Georgia's office to ask for a stay of execution. They said that he doesn't have the power to pass a stay of execution. Is that true?
I don't know. He certainly has the power to grant clemency, and whether the clemency is an all or nothing thing in Georgia. In other words, he'd have to basically let him out of jail or let him go to the gas chamber or however they kill people in Georgia. I don't honestly know the answer to that. The board that is hearing that is the Pardons and Paroles Commission, I believe it is. And if you go to amnestyusa.org, there's the petition and all the information. Monday is the day that that board is meeting, and that's who they're trying to influence, is that board, not the governor. And so
I did sign the petition.
Yeah, okay. So I would do that, and there's a bunch of different organizations that are collaborating on this as well. And in addition to Amnesty International, and you might want to hit some of their websites too and see what you can do there. That's everything I know. Everett, thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. Karen in Winter Haven, Florida. Hey, Karen, what's up?
Hey, one thing I wanted to talk a little bit about, when we get involved in our discussions of the birth of the Social Security program, mm-hmm. is that we have to remember there was no FDIC or any insurance for savings and bank accounts back during the Great Depression.
Right. So when a bank went down, it took everybody's money with it, and they never got it back.
Absolutely. And that was pointed out to me by my professor at Baruch College in history, because his grandmother lost her entire life savings.
Yeah, the same thing happened to my mother. My mother's family was not, you know, real well off, but they had a, you know, they were kind of the professional middle class, I guess you would say. And they got wiped out in the Great Depression, absolutely wiped out. And to the point that my mom, she would tell stories about how they would, when she was going to, she went to Michigan State University, she propped planes at the airport on the weekends, and she was a lifeguard up in Charlevoix all summer long to pay for the tuition. But they would squeeze the toothpaste tubes in the door jams to get the last of the toothpaste out, and they would count how many pieces of toilet paper they were using. I mean, the generation that survived that, it really changed their lives.
Well, it informed my father's life even more than World War II. He talked about it and gave me a lot of the background history on it. But the point being that the banksters got the money again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, they got it back in those days, and they got it again now with the people with 401ks and so forth. And that, we seem to forget that, when we forget that if Social Security stays with our government, it's safe. You know, if we start privatizing this thing and changing it all around, we're going to lose it.
Well, look at what happened in Chile. The average, you know, management fees, when Chile in 1981, when dictator Pinochet privatized the Social Security system in order to help out his bankster buddies, the average overhead went from the 2 or 3% that the government had to, you know, the cost of administering a Social Security program, to between 14 and 20%. To the point, and it's gotten so bad that in 2008, Michelle Bachelet, I think is how her name is pronounced, the president of Chile, said, okay, we're going to put a government program back into place because this private thing ain't working. It ain't working at all. People are getting negative incomes because the management fees were wiping out their savings. So you're absolutely right. Well said.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
And on the news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in Madison, Wisconsin, where Fighting Bob Fest is happening this weekend. This is going to be a hoot. We're doing a gig with Bernie Sanders tonight, but tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. In fact, it's moved into the Alliant Energy Center, the giant Coliseum. Is last year I spoke along with at that time it was Jim Hightower and Jesse Jackson Jr. and there was a bunch of other speakers. Those were the ones that were John Nichols. This year it's going to be Senator Bernie Sanders, Tammy Baldwin, Cornel West, Jim Hightower, me, Alan Bravo, Dave Obie, Greg Pallas, Tony Schultz, John Nichols. It's quite a lineup, and I think it's going to be fascinating. It's going to be a lot of fun. Anyhow, if anything goes Friday, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, your phone calls. Tim Carpenter may drop by. In fact, he's supposed to be a guest right now, but he hasn't made it here. I'm guessing he's out lost, driving around trying to find the place. So we'll, you know, when he drops in, we'll share that story with you. But for right now, Michelle in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Michelle, thanks for listening to AM 1260. What's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, I feel that Obama's biggest problem might be relatively simple, which is that the bad guys don't fear him. And they certainly don't fear Eric Holder, because I don't know what he's doing. And so this lack of political respect, it just grows and grows and grows. He's established himself as a nice guy, but he hasn't established himself as a good guy.
Well, or maybe he's established himself as a good guy, but he hasn't established himself as a formidable force. I mean, Lyndon Johnson was a force of nature. And as was arguably George W. Bush, once they decided they were going to do something, they were going to get something, they were going to have something, even if 100,000 people died and 5 million people were thrown out of their homes, they got it.
Well, I think that's what they're reacting to with Perry. And I fear that's what Mitt's problem is.
Yes, Mitt is a nice guy President Obama. He has that more collegial personality. And Perry is like George Bush. And I think, frankly, the American people, particularly during a time of crisis, and this economic crisis that we're experiencing right now, I think that they're completely misunderestimating, to use a Palinism or a Bushism, one or the other. They're completely underestimating how much of a crisis this is perceived as by so many Americans. I mean, when I've got taxi drivers. I don't want to out an individual taxi driver, but I've had taxi drivers tell me on more than one occasion. In fact, even just last week, again, without going into the specifics, but basically, I mean, what I'm hearing from folks, I mean, our callers to our show, to the people who picked me up in taxis, is that they're freaked out and they feel that the president is not being harsh enough or forceful enough, or he's not taking names and kicking ass enough, and he's starting to do that. And let's just hope that he does it a whole lot more, because I think you're right, Michelle. I think that if we don't, if he doesn't, and we don't get out there and support him, and in his doing that, if there isn't more support for this, and he compromised, I mean, John Boehner came out today and said there's no way there's going to be any tax cuts or tax increases, rather. You're going to have to go after entitlement programs. This is the end play of Jude Winiski's Two Santa Claus theory. This is where the Democrats are forced to shoot Santa Claus.
Yes, and I feel like we have been pushing President Obama up.
Oop, Michelle, I'm sorry. I just dropped you. My apologies. That was entirely my fault. Ron in Altoona, Wisconsin. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hey, Tom, it's great to talk to you again. Mine is kind of a different kind of question, because they usually are when I talk to you. I've been noticing lately on television these ads that have been going on. The most recent one I saw last night, I believe it was for against the EPA, where they're saying how the EPA is holding back the country from progressing and all this type of thing.
Right.
Where are these generated from? And I've also noticed ones about fracking, defending fracking the same way, and another one about the oil companies.
Yeah.
I've never seen ads like this before.
This is the oil industry pushing back against attempts to legislatively and regulatorily control them. The fracking industry is pushing back on the movie Gasland. They're horrified by the fact that the word is out that fracking does cause contamination of wells, contamination of groundwater, might even be associated with earthquakes. And so the fracking industry is running all these sweet ads about how wonderful and everything is. And, you know, we have these little cement liners and everything. And we're the good fracking company. They're the bad fracking company, that kind of stuff. So you've got that. Yeah. The anti-EPA ads. I mean, this is kind of Koch Brothers 101, whether it's coming from them or not, I don't have any idea. But this is the ideology that regulation is bad, combined with somebody makes money from not being regulated. So they take that money and invest it in television advertising. And if they can convince enough people to go along with, I think the main thing that they're trying to do is immunize largely Republican, but some blue dog Democrats as well, but mostly Republican elected officials from being attacked in the 2012 election for wanting the water to be dirtier and the air to be dirtier and the environment to be more poisonous. And so that's what they're doing, is they're trying to immunize these people. And I think that that's the core of the ads, Ron. I think that's where it's coming from. And, you know, it's obvious. I mean, this is big bucks playing itself out. DiCarlo in Oakland, California. I'm going to be going through calls fairly quickly here today because it's anything goes Friday. Hey, DiCarlo, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing, Tom? I just wanted to have a definitive answer for you on this. I've brought this up before, but I'm just wondering, why is it that it seems the Republicans don't want voting, poor people voting, and I'm saying, you know, for the Democrats, why don't we get people motivated to vote? You said it was a bad idea and it would be the death knell for Obama. But I don't understand, if other countries actually do this, if you're getting government assistance, you should be required to vote. If we had that, we could actually change this stuff around. We keep talking about this fear coming in from the corporation side.
What my point was twofold, DiCarlo. Number one, you can't require that. You can't require voting in the United States. Okay, that would be a violation of a person's right to not vote. And so, therefore, since it wouldn't be possible for any politician to suggest that it should happen would be political suicide. I mean, there would be a downside. If President Obama was actually able to make it happen and he went out and did it by executive order or by legislatively, that, you know, if you get food stamps, then you're automatically registered to vote. And by the way, if you want to keep getting them, you have to vote. Or for that matter, driver's license or any other criteria, anything else. Student ID, you know, if you're over 18, whatever it may be. I mean, there's a whole bunch of different ways you could do it. You take the political heat, but you'd get the political benefit of all those voters. But my point is he would not get the benefit of the voters because the Supreme Court would knock it down in a New York minute.
Okay, wait, and let me say this. I'm not saying take away their food stamps. What I'm saying is you can reduce them by a certain percentage to then require them. It's like, okay, if you want to continue receiving 100%, then you would have to vote. If not, then we can reduce it down by a percentage for each local, federal, and state election that they miss.
Are you familiar with the history of the motor voter laws?
No, I'm not.
Okay, this came out of the 60s. In the 60s, there were voter registration drives, particularly in poorer neighborhoods, particularly in African American neighborhoods, get people to register to vote. And there were some states where they took it a step farther and said, hey, let's make it super easy for people to register to vote. So when you get your driver's license, you are automatically registered to vote. They were called the motor voter laws. And they were passed in a bunch of states in the 60s and 70s. And now we have states repealing those motor voter laws because the Republicans want to reduce the electorate. This is classic strategy that they've had since the 80s. Cut the number of people who vote, and they'll have more power. They'll have more influence. And that's, you know, that was a beginning point, and that got blown up.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with more of your calls here on Anything Goes Friday. Tom Hartman with you in Madison, Wisconsin.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows. Anything goes.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Helen in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Helen, what's up?
Hi, I'll talk fast. You said you get a lot of calls. Yeah. The first thing I wanted to address was the election problems. When a few callers back, Jimmy Carter, he had a lengthy interview, I don't know, on NPR or something, and he said that the United States of America does not meet the minimum criteria for doing what he does, is supervising elections in other countries. I did what your mom did, too. I used to be an election inspector. And,
that's great. Good
idea. That's kind of like shameful that he goes to other countries and they're better than we are. So Eric Holder is a twiddling his thumbs. I don't know what he's doing. And third thing I wanted to ask is, what is happening to the former governor of Alabama, Siegelman?
Siegelman.
Yeah, is he doing okay? Or
he's been partially cleared and partially not. The problem is that the person who was persecuting him, as
wife of a friend.
Either she's still around, or the judge that went after him originally is still his judge, And we'll have to get Don back on. You can read the whole story over at donsiegelman.com.
Okay.
And I've been getting bits and pieces of it over the months, and I don't want to mix my stories up while I'm on the air here and
okay.
give you the wrong information. But I do encourage people to go to Don Siegelman, I before E, donsiegelman.com, and or maybe it's .org, maybe it's both, and see his story in his own
okay.
words and watch the interview with 60 Minutes, and he's certainly told the story many times on this program, because that was an example of where the Bush administration was using the Office of the Attorney General to aggressively do things, and the federal prosecutors. I mean,
the Obama administration could have like cleaned, got rid of some of these corrupt people,
and should have. He should have asked for the
yeah.
resignation of all of them on day one and failed
right.
to. And it's something that to this day baffles me why he didn't. Helen, thank you for the call. Very well said. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. In listening to your show today, I see a theme emerging, and maybe you haven't thought of it quite this way, or maybe your listeners, but I see this emerging of like this middleman inveigling in between the person selling the product or the commodity and the person actually using the product or actually performing the service, whether it's, you know, getting rid of the commodity, you know, passing the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, where now speculators control the actual raw products as opposed to taking actual delivery, or we're talking about truckers and how the brokers have been inveigling their way in. And I've seen this, and what's even more egregious in our labor market is in the tech field, where you have all these body shops, all these middle people kind of getting in between the customer that actually needs to get the job done and the people doing the work. And so you might have two, three, even four layers. So I saw this theme emerging, and I wanted to add to this middleman business also in the tech field. And I think there needs to be real reform in terms of how our economy works between the people paying for the service or the people paying to get delivery of the product and the people actually doing the work or actually using the product to deliver a refined good or end product. And I think we really need to look at that in terms of our labor market and the way our economy works, because there's just too many non-productive people in the middle extracting and really dumbing down hiring and productivity of the people doing the work, of the people actually wanting to use that product for end result, like a trucking company or an airline. And I thought this is – I saw this.
It's called the financialization of an economy. And Kevin Phillips wrote a book about it. And it's what we're seeing is that these middlemen, these financial services companies, these brokers, these – you know, as markets become less and less regulated and more vulnerable to this kind of thing, this is what you see. And so we've got speculators driving up the cost of commodities, whether it's wheat or whether it's oil. You've got, as the trucker who called a while ago pointed out, you've got middlemen now in the trucking industry who do absolutely nothing except sit around and play middleman. I think you're right. I think you've done a very good job of identifying that, David.
I want to add, and I could be wrong, but I remember the state of Virginia passing a law that said when it came to IT contracts that there had to be a certain minimal amount that a middleman could take before it actually went to the actual tech worker doing the work. And I don't remember the details, but if somebody from Virginia remembers this, but this is the type of thing that needs to be reformed in terms of the high-tech or high-skilled labor market in this country, because right now the hiring has gotten dumbed down. There's too many fingers in the pie. They have these vendor management systems that basically allow the actual company employer-employee deniability so they
right.
can get all the benefits of the labor without taking any responsibility for the people actually doing the work
right.
for them.
And you can track a lot of that back to Taft-Hartley as well. No, you're absolutely right. And very well said, David. Thank you very much for the call. Let's see here. Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark, what's up? We got a minute to the break.
I just want to say that, like, when Ron Paul said, he said that's what freedom's all about, taking risks, you know, and that sort of thing. He has a warped idea of what is freedom. You know, it's like the programs like Medicare, Social Security, you know, like, or a single-payer health care system, they actually give people more freedom, you know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, Social Security, Medicare, they give seniors more freedom, you know. So, you know, like having to pay your life savings and work your life away to pay a medical bill, that's, you know, that's slavery. That's not freedom, you know what I mean?
Yep,
so,
I do.
You know, yeah.
I totally agree. Go ahead.
Government in a democratic society is a good thing. You know, it's like they taught us in school. You know, democratic government makes us all free. You know, enables us to be free. Otherwise, you have freaking anarchy, where the strong abuse the weak and affect the tyranny over the weak. You know, and that's the legitimate function of government, is to protect the weak from the strong. And those people are the Ron Pauls are the strong. And they want to be able to abuse the weak, and that's why
Ron Paul's campaign manager died $400,000 in debt, because Ron Paul's campaign doesn't pay for health insurance. It's really quite incredible. We'll be back 27 minutes past here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
$2 trillion in offshore money creating jobs. The GOP are reactionaries. The using words to minimize the crisis. Obama's going to Boehner. Some of the topics. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday, live from Madison, Wisconsin, where tomorrow the Fighting Bob Fest. It'll be Senator Sanders, Congresswoman Tammy Baldwin, Cornell West, Jim Hightower, Tom Hartman, Ellen Bravo, David Obey, Greg Palast, and John Nichols, and others. We're going to have a great time. Larry in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Larry, what's up?
I just wanted to talk to you about the Supreme Court. And since they've been letting corporations give all the money they want, some of those people that own those corporations must be foreigners. So how can they give all the money they want? And by accepting that as officials, wouldn't it be treasonous?
Well, this was a point that was made in the dissent in the Citizens United case. Justice Stevens wrote in the dissent his concern that foreign corporations or foreign individuals will now become big influencers. And you get companies like, for example, Fox News. I think 7% is the percentage of ownership of News Corp by Prince Sultan bin Talawid, whatever his name is, the guy who tried to give $10,000 to New York after 9/11, and Rudy Giuliani turned it down. Here's a company that's partly foreign-owned, or you've got companies that are entirely foreign-owned that are coming into the United States. They're lobbying. They're participating. I mean, you know, Fox News or News Corp, I believe, gave $1 million to the Republican Governors Association in the last cycle. It was a substantial contribution in any case. So, yes, that is a real problem, and it is going on as we speak, and expect to see a whole lot more of it. And, you know, thanks very much, Citizens United, to the five of the nine kings of America on the Supreme Court. John in Troy, Michigan. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, in January, the state of Michigan is going to start taxing pensions, and you know, our Governor Snyder, he talks about shared sacrifice. If you have $1 million a year as a pension, you're going to pay $3,500 state income tax. If you make $48,000 a year as a pension, you're going to pay $3,130.
So he's basically capped the tax on pensions, so it hits working people and not rich people.
Right.
Yeah.
Also, someone called you earlier.
Why am I not surprised?
Yeah. Somebody called you earlier about the Michigan Democratic Party. The reason they're not working to recall Snyder, they say the Michigan Democratic Party says they do not have enough money to do it. Also, the unions are not participating in recalling Snyder. So, you know, it's a hard push.
Yeah, but there is a recall movement. There is a grassroots recall movement.
Yeah.
And people are gathering petitions. And is there any kind of center for this? Is there a central website or something?
If you go online, there is. I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah,
but
just Google recall Rick Snyder. You'd probably track it down fairly easily.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Great. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Cheyenne, I don't see a city here for you, Cheyenne. I'm sorry.
It's Long Beach, California.
Oh, okay. Hey, what's up?
Oh, let me start by saying in regards to the comment during the debate regarding Ron Paul,
mm-hmm.
my wife, she just recently got another job, which she got health care for the family. And but the problem is, more than half of her salary goes to pay for the health care benefits. Now, yes. Years ago, we used to pay it out. We used to buy health care on our own.
Yeah.
But then it got to like $800 a month. So we had to drop it. So for years, you know, our family, we didn't have health care coverage until she just got this most recent job. But like I say, more than half of her salary goes to pay for those health benefits. So under the Ron Paul analogy, I guess, you know, my 12-year-old daughter and my 14-year-old son, or me, or my wife, if we got sick, we should just die. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Well, that's what happened to his campaign manager.
Yeah, you see what I'm saying?
Died in debt. Yeah, no, I see exactly what you're saying, and it is a perverse. It's a perversion of freedom to say that people are more free when they are more free to die in the gutter, basically.
Yeah, and let me say this one other thing about the banking,
yeah.
and all the thievery that went on Wall Street. I got a brother-in-law in the state of California, and people out there need to hear this. In the state of California, that's serving a 45-to-life sentence for stealing a bicycle. A bicycle.
There's a three strikes.
45 to life for stealing a bicycle. But people on Wall Street in this country can steal trillions of dollars from the working people. And the clown toy attorney general, Eric Holter, allow these people to run free, but yet and still, you give a man 45 to life for stealing a bicycle. He been in prison about 15 years for stealing a bicycle.
That's
45
amazing.
To life.
That's amazing.
Now, if that doesn't say something about this country, I don't know what else there is to be said.
You know,
Thank you, Mr. Hartman, for taking the call.
You're welcome, Shannon. Thank you very much for listening and for calling in. When I was, I took the subway to the airport in Washington, D.C., to fly out here to Madison yesterday. And when I arrived at Reagan National, or as most people who live and work around there prefer to call it, National Airport. When I arrived at the airport, I'm coming down off the subway, and it's one of these, you know, the subway's going down this big corridor, and there's this giant poster. And it said, "Welcome to America." And there's a picture of the Statue of Liberty. Beautiful picture of the Statue of Liberty, big letters across the top, "Welcome to America." And then across the bottom in large type, it said, "Home of 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners." And then in smaller type at the bottom, it said, "ACLU, you know, we can build a better America." It's true. Rick in Oklahoma City. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? What I was wondering about was, like on the president's jobs plan,
mm-hmm.
I'm kind of ambivalent about any of these tax cuts or rebates or whatever you want to call them. I think you ought to just throw everything at infrastructure.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that he should be enforcing the Buy American Act. And you know, but that's not that's not what he put together. And
I know, but the only reason it would never
pass Congress.
The only reason I'm thinking that way is because you make it real simple. There's, you know, I mean, it would either be in up or down.
Yeah, no, people understood the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. They understood the Civilian Conservation Corps. You know, we're going to hire 250,000 people and put them to work planting trees and stopping soil erosion. And we're going to hire 1,000,000 people and put them to work rebuilding, you know, building roads and dams. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt did it. Very straightforward, very simple. People got it. On the other hand, Franklin Roosevelt had an overwhelming Democratic and progressive Democratic majority in both the House and the Senate. And Barack Obama doesn't right now. So we're seeing to a certain extent the politics of compromise, which seems to be his style and nature, but it's also the politics of compromise, which is made necessary by the political reality of the moment, tragically. Eric in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I had a question. Don't you think that we should be calling conservatives what they really are? They're more reactionaries. Yeah, because from everything from their, you know, policies on like EPA and, you know, just every kind of policy, they want to roll back the clock 70 years. Don't you agree?
I do. Frankly, I think they want to roll it back a little more than 70 years, but certainly back before the New Deal. I think they want to roll it back before the 1907 Tillman Act, which said that it was a crime. This was during the Teddy Roosevelt administration, Republican administration, by the way, that it was a crime to for corporations to give money to politicians. And it still is, by the way. You've got to go around by the back door to do it. And, you know, they want to roll back. In fact, I'd say they want to take us back before 1881 and the Sherman Antitrust Act. So they want to take us back to the age of the robber barons, the 1870s, the 1880s, the Gilded Age. I'm with you, Eric. And you know, whether that's reactionary or not, or just regressive, I suppose we could debate. But it's wrong. James in Long Island, New York. Hey, James, what's up?
Hi, two quick questions. Based on your recommendation, I read the Fawn Brody Thomas Jefferson bio.
Yeah, isn't that brilliant?
I was just wondering if you could recommend one more about his the political aspects of his career.
Wow, I can't right offhand. The two most recent biographies of Jefferson that I've read, and it's been, you know, 5-6 years since I did. Were both written by people who represented themselves as historians, but clearly had a conservative bias, you know, and they were in some ways trying to reinvent Jefferson as a conservative and or diminish, you know, or put down the things that he was doing that were quite progressive. I wrote a book called What Would Jefferson Do? I don't put that out as the definitive biography of Jefferson. It certainly is not, or of his politics. We need a good book like that. We really do. And okay, I'm sorry, I'm not the authority on it. Tim Carpenter just walked in, and I think I just got a 1 minute cue too, didn't I? 30 seconds. Okay. Tim Carpenter is going to be with us after the break, with Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. This is the inside outside strategy. This is Let's Change America and Let's Change the Democratic Party. So you may want, in anticipation of this, and Tim's going to be at this Fighting Bob Fest gig that we're at. Tomorrow it's going to be at the Coliseum at the Atlanta Energy Center in Madison, Wisconsin. Something that you should be thinking about creating for your community. Bernie Sanders will be there, Congresswoman Tammy Baldwin, Dr. Cornel West, Jim Hightower, me, David Obie, Greg Palast. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be really interesting. Stick around. Tim Carpenter will be with us right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls and Tim. Stick around.
Trees of green.
Jacob, are they on the one sheet?
Roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean. Great job doing the news today, Jacob. To our video directors, Chris Bryant and Eric Hamilton, to our phone screener, Julie Lulley, and writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbrook for our YouTube productions, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at our syndicators, Dow Global, Pacifica Radio, Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, all the others around the country, to Monica Ashvie, Dennis Trunov, Don Rojas, and all the other great folks at Free Speech TV, and RTTV, who work on the big picture, to Rachel in Santa Fe, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room. Hey, how you doing? To Ellen Ratner and all the great folks at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. All that said, Tim Carpenter in the studio with me, and Tim is the... Your title is a funky title.
Director.
Yeah, director.
But organizer at that most.
Yeah. I'm a director of Progressive Democrats. I'm used to like CEOs or something. I don't know.
No, this is PDA.
Yeah.
Or grassroots.
There you go. We're grassroots. So you're the director, but not the executive director, just the director.
Director. We keep it simple.
Yeah. Okay. I'm all in favor of that. Progressive Democrats of America, what is it?
Year 7, Tom. We're continuing as we began in 2004. and the belief that it's time that the grassroots Democrats take back our party. The progressives who are working at the local level begin to move the party back to where we believe it should be. In 2004, many of us were very active in Dennis Kucinich's campaign, Howard Dean, and we weren't successful in getting the debate we wanted so much on those issues that reunited us in 2004. So the last day when the Democrats met at the National Convention, we thought it was time to leave there organized. And for the last seven years, we've been out in the streets organizing inside and outside the party, which makes us a little different in working with what we call street heat and working at the local level within our Democratic parties on those issues we began our discussion on, single payer and ending the war.
Yeah, and I think that that's such a brilliant strategy because the kind of inside-outside strategy allows you to avoid becoming the circular firing squad and yet at the same time put an enormous pressure on people to move in a progressive direction while at the same time being the wind behind their back.
Yeah, it's unique in that we've positioned ourselves in the belief, and some people get confused, we're not the Democratic Party, we're the insurgency. We want the Democratic Party to become a party that FDR promised us and Harry Truman, a party of single payer and for a real new deal. And in order to do that, we have to elect progressives across the country, progressive Democrats, but we have to also bring the street heat. What we're seeing out in the streets right now with this economic crisis, people that don't have health insurance, people that don't have the medical coverage they so desperately deserve, or simply a job or to make the rent. Take that street heat, bring it into the Congress. Every great social movement from the women's movement to the civil rights movement began as street heat and ended up in the halls of Congress, whether it was Rosa Parks beginning in the 50s and a bus working with Dr. King and finally being in the Rose Garden with President Lyndon Johnson. That's what PDA is about, to connect those movements inside and outside.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely spectacular. And so many people miss either half of it. You know, it's like, oh, you've got to just totally work inside the. The example that I think every American should you know understand very easily and get is the Tea Party. You know, the Tea Party was an insurgent movement. It was, of course, you and I both know it was funded by billionaires, but and multimillionaires, Dick Armey, and they had these large budgets with the PR firms in Los Angeles, New York, and D.C. And they had an entire television network behind them. But nonetheless, for the average person who participated in the Tea Party, it was a grassroots movement that basically has taken over or has a powerful, powerful influence on the Republican Party to the point that there's, you've got Republican debates about who can be more like the Tea Party. And how do we accomplish something like that on our side?
Well, it's happening right now under the radar, Tom. People aren't aware of it, but at the grassroots level, if we look at the state of California, all the way out to Massachusetts and into Arizona, grassroots Democrats, progressive Democrats like ourselves, are getting elected to their local central committees. You and I can go to our local committees and get elected. We can go to our county central committees and ultimately to our state conventions and pass resolutions, just as the Tea Party has done to put the Republican Party on record. We're doing that right now. That's what PDA is about. In California, Massachusetts, and Arizona, three states, none of which are alike, and all three of those states, progressive Democrats like Tea Parties and their respective parties have gone to the local conventions, gotten elected, gone to the state, and in California, Massachusetts, and Arizona today, the Democratic Party is on record in support of single-payer health care, getting out of Afghanistan for Wall Street, transaction tax. So those issues are resonating at the local level. That's how we do it. It's how in 1964, when Lyndon Johnson won the presidency, many people didn't realize what was happening underneath at the Republican Party when Barry Goldwater, during that blowout from 64 to 80, the Republicans did just what they have accomplished. They elected Ronald Reagan working at the grassroots level. That's the strategy of PDA. That's what's unique. So you work inside the party, but you also bring those people that are alienated inside the party to do the work. And we also bring the Democrats outside the party to do that important street heat work, connecting them both inside and out.
Yeah, I remember that well. You know, my dad, a Republican, very active Republican and a big Goldwater supporter in 64, and he and all his friends, they thought the world had come to an end, and then they went out and got active. And you know, the Republican Party, one of the other things that they did is they got real active inside the churches. I suppose the organized structure that's the natural constituency of the Democratic Party, there are some progressive churches, you know, the United Church of Christ and others, but the natural constituency is labor.
Exactly. And for us, PDA, that's the National Nurses United, Who better than the nurses that lead the fight for single payer? There's an organization many people aren't even aware of, but there's U.S. Labor Against the War, union activists at the grassroots level working at their central labor councils, putting the party on record. For the first time, the FLCIO now has embraced single payer, working with our good friend Bernie Sanders finally in the Senate to bring about single payer. Unions are certainly that backbone.
Absolutely spectacular. Tim Carpenter, Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. Get thee to the website and get on the mailing list. Find out what's going on. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. When you show up and participate, tag, you're it. We'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartmann. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.